This podcast is from the RAND Corporation, a nonprofit institution that helps improve policy and decision-making through research and analysis. For more RAND analysis, reports, and commentary on issues at the forefront of today's policy debate, visit www.rand.org.
Thanks for coming. Thanks for being here with us this morning. I know it's been a busy week on Capitol Hill, but we're very glad to have you here. My name is Jamie Fugelson. I'm the Director of Congressional Relations for the RAND Corporation, and I'm very pleased to welcome you to our briefing today. How do we prevent the next homegrown terrorist? The topic today is a pretty serious one. Although 9/11 and the threat of attack from Al-Qaeda and ISIS shaped our response to terrorism, the history of terrorism in the United States is a long one. Attacks have come from groups and individuals inspired by different ideologies, pursuing very different goals in virtually all 50 states. Given the complexity and scope of this challenge, the question we really tried to address with this research is, what is the right terrorism prevention strategy? And that was the question that HSOAC examined. The research team studied past and current terrorism prevention efforts in the United States, and then they reviewed policy options to strengthen terrorism prevention going forward. Today, we're going to hear highlights from this research, including a discussion on the nature of the homeland terrorist threat, an assessment of past and current terrorism prevention policies, activities, and capabilities. And then finally, we'll talk about how policymakers can support terrorism prevention programs and enable innovation in these programs. It's my pleasure to welcome Brian Jackson as our discussant today. He is a principal investigator, he's the principal investigator on this research and a senior physical scientist at RAND. His research focuses on homeland security, criminal justice, and emergency preparedness. His terrorism-focused research has examined things like organizational learning by terrorist groups' use of technology, combating violent extremism and terrorism prevention, development of assessment methods for novel terrorist threats, and strategies to respond to terrorist targeting of national economies. Brian has his master's in science, technology, and public policy from George Washington University and a PhD in bio and organic chemistry from the California Institute of Technology. So with that, I'm very pleased to turn it over to Brian to start our discussion today. Thank you again for being here.
Great. Thanks very much. So the study that we're focused on today, to sort of start with definitions. So terrorism prevention is the policy space, including programs, interventions that are intended to complement traditional law enforcement approaches to responding to individuals who might pose a threat. For those of you who are interested in terminology, these policies are frequently covered by the terms combating violent extremism. In the U.S., that's been subsumed by terrorism prevention as a moniker for this policy space and broadened somewhat. But that terminology is still used in some other countries. As you'll sort of see through the discussion, this is a somewhat fraught policy area. It's controversial. We're intervening with people who may not have broken the law. And it's an area where there have been questions about how effective what we've done in the past has been. And so this study was aimed to help inform DHS and help inform policy development, really doing a fundamental look, sort of looking back, looking forward, to identify options to strengthen national performance in this particular policy space going forward. Since I'm a researcher, I feel obligated to sort of give you a feel for how we did this. There's been a lot of written on combating violent extremism, terrorism prevention over the years, so we did our best to go to the literature and really synthesize, stand on the shoulders of everyone that came before. The heart of our work was actually a very extensive interviewing effort, however, where we started at the national level. We talked to federal agencies that are involved in this, folks who are currently involved in this mission space, folks who have previously been involved in that mission space, other think tanks, national-level organizations with sort of an interest in this area, but then went down to the implementation level. So a lot of this programming is implemented at the state and local level. That's really where the rubber meets the road. And so we visited five different cities. My list to make sure that I don't forget any of them. We went to Los Angeles, Denver, Houston, Boston, and Minneapolis to try to get a uniform picture across the country of what was being done in this area, and also really get perceptions from folks who are involved in implementation about what works, what doesn't work. So in these, we talked to law enforcement, local government, community organizations, civil society organizations, social services agencies. Across all of these, it's important to sort of be upfront. We weren't able to talk to everyone that we reached out to. As I mentioned, CVE in the past and terrorism prevention now is a controversial policy area, and there were some folks who didn't feel comfortable participating. But we still felt like we had an obligation to be inclusive of their sort of interests and equities, and so we relied on information that was available publicly to try to do that as best as we could. We looked at other countries. There are obviously experiences in other countries that can be learned from, open source threat analysis, and then trying to bring it together at the end. So to give you a map of where we're going here, sort of as was mentioned in the intro, we're going to talk about the nature of the terrorist threat, just sort of a sketch of sort of the problem this is aimed at solving. The heart of the briefing is really our assessment of past CVE and current terrorism prevention activities. What are we doing? How's it working? And then the end point of this is really sort of looking forward. You know, what are the options for strengthening terrorism prevention capability as an element of dealing with threats from violent extremism nationally? So in terms of the terrorist threat, we looked for sort of different lenses to think this through. Average number of incidents, so our focus was mostly in the years since 9/11 as kind of the period that we thought was most relevant for thinking about terrorism prevention in the U.S. We've been relatively fortunate compared to some other countries. An average of about 25 incidents a year, although that has ticked up recently. I should name check that this is all data from the University of Maryland START Center and their various data sets. The bottom line on individuals who have radicalized is somewhat similar. There are a few more because, of course, some of those individuals have not progressed to actually acting out and causing terrorist incidents. But about 70 per year on average over the years. But again, you know, an uptick recently, 150 recently. Yes?
In terms of definitions, how would you define radicalized? Because 154 would seem to be depending on sort of how you define that, it could seem to be too low of a number, too high of a number, or someplace in between.
So the data sets that are put together by the University of Maryland have a definition for what they include. And I actually have that here. It's individuals espousing either Islamist far-right, far-left, or single-issue ideologies who have radicalized within the United States to the point of committing an ideologically motivated violent act, joining an organization, or associating with a leader, or associating themselves with a leader of a similar organization. So it is not necessarily having broken the law, but it is a relatively explicit definition of acting on belief. Does that address it? However, emphasizing in some ways that is somewhat of a low number, when you think about this as a national problem, 50 states, we're talking about not very many people in any given city, for example. So looking from the national level, looking from the bottom up, we're going to get to the point about talking about programs and putting programs in place in a major city or a small town, and how to have programs that are appropriate and sustainable for the fact that they may have only a few people in their local area that they need to respond to on a given year. The other piece of this, in terms of open investigations, the footprint of radicalization and ideological violence threat on law enforcement is a lot of work. The best sort of measures that we could find for thinking about how much level of effort that this is requiring from law enforcement was from the FBI director's testimony. It was in 17 because we completed the study over the last year. That we're talking in the low thousands of numbers of open investigations, whether that was for jihadist-inspired terrorism, threats from other ideologies. And for folks who sort of are aware of what law enforcement does, there's a lot of level of effort and work there that can't be applied to other issues. So in thinking about terrorism prevention programs as a complement to law enforcement, one of the potential benefits or addressing sort of reducing other threats is the potential for these programs to free up some of those law enforcement resources to work on other things. So I alluded to, sort of a simple average for if, 154 radicalized individuals were spread across 50 states. The reality is they're not spread evenly, but they are spread. This is a geographic mapping of the University of Maryland data that just sort of tags that, we are talking about national issues here. So if you're thinking about terrorism prevention capability as an element of protecting the whole country from incidents of ideological violence, we have to have capability that can serve someone radicalizing potentially in all 50 states. And the other lesson about threat is that ideological sources of threat have changed a lot over time. So in the document there, in the executive summary, we have one that sort of goes back much more historical, but just for the purposes of briefing, we focused on the same window from 2002 on. And you can see that we have ideological people sort of radicalizing based on a wide variety of ideologies. I haven't labeled all of them since I didn't want to fill up the slide completely. The full legend is in the executive summary, which have gone up and down over time. And so the only point here in thinking about programming is, although we have to be cognizant of what the ideological sources of violence are, we can't sort of optimize our programs for just one, or they're likely not going to stand the test of time, because there has been a lot of variation even within the last decade, and when you look even further back, there are sort of many other flavors of ideology that have led people toward violence. So now in thinking about sort of what we're doing now and the perceptions about the sort of the level of sufficiency of terrorism prevention, capability in the country, the process that we went through for this was largely based on our interviews. We looked back at CVE, so this is sort of looking sort of all the way back as far as we could go. I mean, CVE sort of started in the United States not immediately after 9/11, but it scoped up in the years since then, and also things that have been going on more recently. This was driven by the interview data sort of from the national level, and then using our five cities as kind of, you know, sort of views into what was going on in different regions of the country. So to think about terrorism prevention, one of the challenges is that there are a whole lot of different policies that fall into the general sort of category of terrorism prevention policy. Everything from messaging all the way, you know, up to, you know, sort of intervening with people who might be at risk. And I'll go into those in more sort of detail in a moment. And so we needed a way to think through how to break that up. And the way that we did that was thinking about sort of the audiences of different categories of policy. There are academics who have studied how people radicalize, thinking about sort of different stages that people go through as a way to help think this through. We started from that, but we sort of tried to keep it as simple as we could. And so we really boiled it down to three groups. You've got sort of a vulnerable population from which some people might radicalize. If you're thinking the most generally, this could be the entire population of the United States. If you're thinking about homegrown violent extremism across all ideologies and so on. Through a process of radicalization, whatever that process is, there's a lot of variation individual to individual. Some subset of those people become radicalized, sort of entering what we have sort of as a middle state here of people who have been doing things that would lead you to believe that they might be threats. Browsing extremist websites, potentially making threats that don't yet cross a line through, you know, doing something explicitly illegal. One of the challenges here is that some of those people will go on to act and become threats. A lot of those people won't. This is a challenge in sort of discerning what we call the true threats from the false positives. But in any case, we're talking about a much smaller group here. This is tagged at the 150 number. So we're talking, you know, in the hundreds of people nationally. And then some subset of those folks will go on to do something. And so our third sort of audience for policy was people who've mobilized, who've broken the law, who've taken preparatory activities, who have been prosecuted for material support, or have been incarcerated for actually doing something. And so you've got, you know, again, now a much smaller group. Incident numbers, you know, in the tens per year. So here we're talking about, you know, tens of hundreds of incidents, which might have one person involved in each of them, a few. So just to make the point that in thinking about terrorism prevention, sort of we've got a very broad population at this end that sort of comes down to a smaller population to be focused on later. So now what I'm going to do is try to summarize kind of in one slide per population, both what the option space looks like, you know, sort of what's included in terrorism prevention for each of these audiences, and then go through what we learned about what we're doing and the perceptions of whether it's successful or not. And so, you know, at the very broad population level, you know, these are, you know, sort of, you know, to use a medical analogy, broad spectrum, you know, sort of treatments of the whole country. You know, things like countering extremist messaging on the internet and social media, something that's been a focus, you know, here on the Hill recently. You know, to try to make the whole sort of information space, you know, less motivating towards violence. But this also includes other very broad programs, some of which are terrorism specific and some of which may not be. So these are things like community education and engagement, you know, help parents understand, you know, to how to assess behaviors that their kids might be going through. But also very broad programs like resilience, you know, trying to increase the resilience of a community to radicalization and risk factor reduction. So these are things like youth programs, you know, a youth soccer program, economic development, job training, et cetera. So these are programs that might not have anything to do in their name about terrorism, but by reducing risk factors associated with terrorism, reduce the risk of individual radicalization. So for folks who sort of are familiar with some of the lines of research in there, that's sort of the public health approach, if you will, to violence prevention is generally the label that people are using for that. So in looking at these, We tried to walk through with all of the information that we could build what the, you know, sort of successes and gaps in these different areas were. And so in terms of messaging, you know, sort of the data that we were collecting here was about a year ago we were doing most of our interviews. And, you know, so the message that we got on, you know, sort of messaging online was that, you know, much of the focus at the federal level was on motivating technology firms to address, you know, extremist messaging. At that time, there was sort of the view that there had actually been quite a bit of progress made. You know, we did do interviews with some members of the tech community. You know, they talked to us about, you know, what they were doing at the time. However, recent events in New Zealand clearly demonstrate that there's obviously more that can be done here. But this is something where, you know, sort of the bottom line is, you know, sort of the federal government is focused on coordination. In terms of actual counter messaging. So, you know, there's one thing about sort of taking messages offline. The other sort of option there is putting messages online that try to undermine the persuasiveness of extremist messages and so on. And, you know, this is something that is fraught for the federal government to be involved in, particularly domestically. It was interesting that we got, you know, somewhat different views about whether it was impossible for the federal government to do that or merely extremely, extremely difficult for the federal government to do that. And so as a result, the activity, you know, sort of domestically focused on counter-messaging has largely been public-private partnerships. The headline one, the example that everyone went to was the peer-to-peer program, which was a DHS and NCTC-supported program that was, that gave very small amounts of funding to, colleges and universities for students to learn counter-messaging. So this became part of their coursework. Facebook, I believe, was the main company that was involved, provided them some internet, you know, sort of advertising credits. And, you know, that was viewed as actually something that had been a success, not just because it produced counter-content and put it online, but because of the educational and human capital elements of what it produced. That had actually, the funding for that had actually ended even before our study started, and so, you know, this was also a lesson that people kept pointing to as, you know, here's something that was successful. The private sector and the NGO community has kept some of that going, but again, that was sort of an example of something where there had been a success that had turned into a gap. So on this second piece, in terms of engagement efforts, you know, this was another element where some of what the federal government had done was viewed as a success here. So the CVE task force, you know, the folks who are interested in interagency coordination was, you know, the element that coordinated all of this, you know, got everyone on the same page in terms of, you know, the brief, you know, community education and awareness briefings that were done, which when we asked people at the state and local level, okay, you know, was this valuable? What did you think of it? You know, the message we got was that it really was valuable. This is another case where, you know, a success has sort of become somewhat of a gap, because there have been staff reductions in this mission space that have led to, you know, kind of unmet demand. You know, there's not enough people to sort of even do, you know, that kind of coordination at the level where there's demand for it. In terms of the resilience and risk factor reduction, so this is one that I probably won't talk to for too long because it's a very it's hard to get your hands around it for thinking about it from a terrorism specific sort of piece. So there's a lot going on. You know, so HHS does grant programs that fund public health interventions, which community partners said if those build communities, if those increase resilience, there's a terrorism benefit to that, and it's a terrorism benefit that doesn't have the risk of stigmatizing those communities as a terrorism-specific intervention, sort of going in, because of concerns about terrorism. We had difficulty sort of getting, our hands around to estimate kind of, what all is being done here. And so the overall message in this was almost an opportunity, where we had community organizations say, look, organizations like Health and Human Services, Department of Education, Department of Labor, can have grant programs that you may target to communities where there's concerns about terrorism risk, but can do it in a very sort of positive and non-controversial way. So this was sort of the first example, kind of in what I've briefed so far, where we sort of heard this kind of message from the community about figuring out how to do these missions in ways that that sidestep some of the fraught nature of sort of intervening with people before they've broken the law. So transitioning to our second group, sort of this middle cadre of people who may be extreme of thought in one way or another, but have not yet gone on to do something violent. I mean, here you're sort of talking about service delivery in some ways. Finding out who these folks are. Is it a kid who's been browsing ISIS websites at a school, which was one example that someone from a school program that we talked to flagged. Figuring out how to identify them, how to refer them someplace to programs that might help them, where the answer may be counseling to get them on the right path, not a referral to law enforcement because of concerns that they're actually violent. And the challenge here was figuring out ways to do this that were sensitive to the fact that many of the folks whose behaviors make them look like threats may not actually go on to become threats. And so, treating them, to use sort of the public health kind of metaphor, might actually do more harm than good and would at the very minimum be inefficient. So here, we asked both at the federal level and in the five cities that we went to, really what capabilities existed, what activities, were in place that were focused on this middle phase. Because in some ways, this is really where kind of the big payoff from terrorism prevention might be, where somebody who might have been referred to the police and investigated instead, is sent to a counseling program and turned around before they end up doing something that, hurts themselves and others. Here, again, sort of the federal efforts here were centered on the CVE task force, community awareness briefings to try to sort of educate people about things to look at. The same staff constraints that I mentioned before limited this. But there are activities sort of in the NGO sector that are doing somewhat similar activities, kind of filling that part. But in all of the cities that we went to, we sort of asked the question of, folks who were involved in this, what do you think the likelihood that somebody who is at risk of going on to commit violence really would get, identified and referred? And most of them thought that the probability was relatively low because there really just wasn't an infrastructure in place to do that. Part of that infrastructure was sort of uniform mechanisms. I mean, there are some DHS grants that are exploring kind of development of referral lines in the NGO community, so there are some seeds planted towards that. But, in most of the places when we asked, well, okay, if you had somebody at risk, who would you expect most people to call? And the answer was usually, well, the only uniform mechanism is to call the police. And given that the intent of terrorism prevention is to sort of complement law enforcement, and one of the reasons why it's intending to do that is because there isn't high trust of law enforcement in all communities, if the police is sort of your only entry point into the system, that gets in the way of these policies actually doing, as much as they could. There are certainly sort of still risk assessment kind of problems, distinguishing, sort of the true threats from the false positives. It's not entirely clear how resolvable a question that is, although some of the local programs that we talked to, sort of had, human intensive ways that, they thought really did actually help them do that over time. There's certainly no easy easy risk assessment tools that let you do it. But the real bottom line here is the actual capacity to do anything, the intervention programming, the counseling capability to, you know, sort of take somebody who looks like a threat and, you know, sort of wrap them in services to deal with the potential risk is very limited. You know, part of this is controversy. You know, part of this is tough capability to build from the federal level down. It's sensitive to have the federal government intervening with people who potentially haven't yet committed any crime. But even these programs that we found that are in place at the local level, it's been tough. You know, that controversy, you know, and concerns about stigmatizing kids in communities, you know, have gotten in the way of sort of specific programs. Practicality has also gotten in the way of having specific programs at the local level. You know, if you're only going to get a few kids a year who might be at risk of ideological violence, they've actually found that it's more efficient to build that into their existing intervention program for things like school violence or, you know, sort of, you know, bullying and et cetera, and to be able to sustain that capacity over time. And so there are areas that have sort of squared that circle of, you know, how to manage both the sensitivities associated with this mission space and the practicality issues with this mission space, but at a very small scale. So again, sort of the mechanism or sort of the bottom line here is that, you know, even though there is capability out there, it's very, very local and very, very limited. So in thinking about, you know, whether terrorism prevention policy is really sort of nationally reducing risk in the way that traditional law enforcement interventions in this area are nationally reducing risk, we're really not there at that point. So the last and somewhat simpler category is, you know, individuals who are have actually attempted something. They're in the criminal justice system. And so in here, you're mainly talking about terrorism prevention program being akin to recidivism reduction. You know, sort of very similar to, you know, things that might be done for standard violent offenders within the correctional system. In terms of, you know, counseling of different, you know, variants, you know, the elements of community supervision and probation and parole when they leave, conditions of release, and so on. And so here, you know, a lot of the sort of the focus and the need is in the federal correction system. Post 9/11, there were a significant number of individuals who were prosecuted for material support under federal law and are therefore in the federal correctional system. The concern, however, is that many of those individuals are reaching the end of their sentences and will be released into you know, a model of community supervision. And we heard from sort of at multiple levels, you know, the concern that there isn't sort of whether the programming that they've received in prison, you know, whether that's made them more or less radical. It was frankly unclear. And whether the capacity exists to meet their needs in a community supervision context. And this is an area where the federal correctional system is doing things, you know, is learning lessons from other countries. But, you know, sort of our sort of characterization is that they're in sort of the earlier pilot stages, and we're going to have sort of people coming out of institutional corrections into these community corrections programs. And there's a question whether the capability is there to supervise them post-release. We also looked at the state and local level because, of course, although a lot of the focus on sort of extremism and the federal at the federal level is at the federal level, there are also sort of individuals in custody at the state and local level associated with hate crime offenses, associated with you know, crimes that have extremist content. And so because we were taking a national perspective here, we wanted to see whether there was other programming at the local level, if nothing else, where lessons could be learned. And there, the message that we got was that it was very, very little, very, very little. You know, so we even asked the question generally in terms of programming, you know, specific towards, you know, security threat groups and institutions, hate crime, you know, in a convenient sample of sort of correctional administrators who we had access to across the country. And really there wasn't much there. There are a couple of state and local efforts that were funded by the DHS CVE grant program a few years ago. So there are, you know, a couple of programs that are experimenting in this area. But, you know, again, sort of the message is, you know, for this to be a real component and a complement to criminal justice approaches to this problem set, you know, the capability really isn't there. There is some limited activity by NGOs. I mean, the example there is the, I've now lost their name, but it's on a slide later, the one that focuses specifically on individuals who've left, you know, hate groups to intervene after they've left custody. But again, you know, sort of the bottom line here is, you know, this is a more centralized problem set in some ways, but again, still a concern about capability level. So, you know, I flagged, you know, a lot of gaps here. The bottom line is part of the reason why there are that many gaps is that this is actually not a policy area that we have invested that much in. In contrast to very high spending on sort of traditional, you know, other counterterrorism and criminal justice approaches to this, we tried to estimate, you know, sort of what the annual spend on terrorism prevention or in the past CVE was domestically. And the best estimate we could make was sort of in the tens of millions of dollars, so, you know, $20 to $30 million. And while that, you know, that's some resources, you know, compared to many of the other sort of ways, you know, that we spend on national security, that really doesn't seem like much. You know, and $10 million of that, for example, was, you know, the grant program that, you know, tried to plant seeds of capability and programming at the local level. However, just saying we haven't spent that much isn't a particularly satisfying way to argue that, you know, there might be more that we could do here. And so we tried to sort of take some runs at this problem set to say, well, you know, could more funding be justified on this? And we looked at that in three different ways. The first was comparing us with other Western democracies. So we're not the only country that's had problems with terrorism in the years since 9/11. You know, there's a lot of European countries that have been active in CVE. And so what we did, and, you know, so for folks who are more sort of wonkish and numerical, you know, we looked at what they were spending, you know, adjusted for threat, adjusted for population, and tried to see, you know, okay, on this graph, where would the U.S. fall? And the answer, both when we normalized for threat and when we normalized for population, is that what we spend falls at the bottom of the ranges of what other countries spend. So, you know, sort of just comparing us to our peers, we've allocated much less funding to this sort of mission line or this strategy for dealing with terrorist threat than some of our allies and comparable countries have. The other, because of course it's not terribly satisfying to just say we should spend more because others are spending more, was to try to look at, you know, ways of saying, well, all right, how much of the threat space would these programs have to reduce to justify spending more? So this is a variant of, you know, sort of what's known as break-even analysis and regulatory analysis. You go this direction where you've got programs where it's hard to be able to point to say that non-existent terrorism attack that didn't happen because of this program. And it's essentially asking the question, how good would something have to be to justify the spending on it? And we looked at that two ways. I mentioned earlier that one of the concerns here is that just dealing with these threats through the criminal justice system was putting a burden on the system that couldn't be used to deal with other crime and other risk. And so we tried to tote up, you know, what does it cost to deal with somebody who looks like a threat through the criminal justice system? Arrest, investigation, arrest, prosecution, incarceration, often for a significant amount of time, community supervision after they're released. And the bottom line is that that's pretty expensive. You know, essentially what we looked and sort of said, well, you know, okay, if terrorism prevention programming by ramping up and having a more substantial sort of complement to going, you know, after these problems in a traditional criminal justice way took some of that off the plate of, you know, the FBI, local police, you know, court systems, correctional systems, you could justify spending quite a bit more than, you know, $20 or $30 million a year. And the other was looking at the cost of terrorism. There's been a lot of regulatory analysis on security that has focused on this, looking at, you know, sort of net annual, you know, sort of expected losses from terrorism and what fraction of that you'd have to reduce to break even. We actually took a much more simple-minded approach to this and said, all right, most of the terrorist events that folks who are individually radicalizing are end up being sort of small-scale events. So what does a small-scale terrorist event cost? And the answer to that is that actually gets pretty expensive. You don't have to have a 9/11 or a Sri Lanka to end up with damage, human costs, recovery costs, et cetera, that are in the tens of millions of dollars. And this goes back to, you know, sort of people who have analyzed cost of crime. You know, the numbers are sort of in the report for folks who want to look at them. But, I mean, the answer here is, you know, because single events can be in the millions, you wouldn't actually have to prevent very many of them to justify increasing spending in this area. So now our transition, if one sort of buys off that there's a reason to spend more on this, the question is what to do. And so here we want to look at sort of what the menu of options are. The goal here was not to define one path forward. The federal government should. What we tried to do in all of the outreach was, ask the question of people who've been in the trenches, who have been in these programs, how could we do better in the future? Are there things that we haven't done that are attractive? How could then sort of policymakers later put this together into a more substantial and effective policy approach to this area? And the context for kind of our looking forward first was trying to distill kind of what the goal of sort of making policy change in this area would be. And we kind of got this almost incidentally from the way that we approached our interview process. By starting at the federal level, we got a really clear picture of what the goals of these programs are, what we would like terrorism prevention, CVE, these kind of efforts to be able to do. And then by going down to the implementation level, talking to community groups, talking to local cops, et cetera, got a clearer picture of the implementation challenges, like why this was hard. And got a very clear message that this is hard, which we distilled sort of into what we call design challenges to try to convey that in doing, sort of more or different terrorism prevention, there's sort of these, sort of almost specifications, to sort of use engineering terms, that these policies should be designed to try to get at in order to be effective. I mean, there's a bunch in the report. I put, sort of sketched a few up here, but to just go into a couple of them. I mean, the first issue here is really sort of this tension between enforcement approaches and sort of the more collaborative, sort of public health intervention kind of options to dealing with this. Law enforcement has a responsibility to protect the country. If someone looks like they're an imminent threat and they're going to do something, law enforcement needs to act. However, if that person is also in an intervention program and counselors are trying to turn them, the other direction, there's sort of a tension there where, sort of different approaches to a problem can create challenges in maintaining people's willingness to send people to that program. That feeds out to sort of the trust issues that have existed in this. CVE in the past and terrorism prevention now is a very sort of almost incendiary topic because of the concern of stigmatizing individuals and communities, of government sort of intervening with somebody who hasn't broken the law yet and potentially trying to push them into a counseling program or something else that might label them as a potential terrorist. But figuring out sort of how to get sort of square that circle is in some ways probably the most important design challenge here. At the local level, from the bottom up, we saw examples where it actually had been done, sort of models where sort of civil society and community and law enforcement had found a way to all be at the table and manage their various, concerns and equities. But figuring out how to do that is important to get partners to be willing to participate in this, out of concerns of, being connected to security activities and so on, which we can go more into into the Q&A. In the document, we sort of tried to lay out a whole menu. Some of the policy options kind of sidestep this stuff. I only wanted to talk about a couple of them that really take it on head on, particularly since I'm running out of time. The first is figuring out a way for the federal government to actually support state and local activities in this area. There was a CVE grant program. Sort of folks who've been paying attention to this knows that that was controversial. There were some organizations that felt that they couldn't accept money that had a security, sort of flavor to it for fear of alienating sort of people in their other mission spaces, a social services agency, for example. We still need to figure out how to support it from the federal level, though. A lot of the places that we talked to were starved for money in spite of being worried about sort of accepting security-labeled grants. One of the messages here was trying to bring in, sort of more non-security organizations like HHS and Department of Education into this policy space to sort of give more options to support this kind of programming. But this is sort of a challenge. This isn't one of those policy spaces where the usual sort of federal lever of, you know, incentivizing specific activities at the state and local level through funding will work. The second is locally based federal field personnel. There was a time when DHS had sort of a cadre of federal field staff in a lot of different cities whose role was to essentially to help build consensus, build trust, get programming in place, help people navigate where they could get funding, and so on. And it was striking the difference in capability between the cities that we went to that had had really dynamic federal field staff there for many years and the ones that hadn't. In an area where trust is an issue, where there's friction between the federal level and the local level, having somebody who's a real person locally to humanize the mission space, to talk through things, is really, really important. This struck us as, you know, sort of an opportunity to build this back out again and to really make progress. The other is a bigger lesson about balance across programs in terms of trying to include all of the sort of sources of ideological violence, not just because you want programs that are balanced across threats, so you're actually dealing with the threat space, but that's also a trust and a buy-in issue from the perspective of communities and state and locals. Last sort of real substantive slide, and in some ways one of the big challenges for sort of federal program design in this area is that federal efforts also have to be very, very open to flexibility in the way that locals do this. And I just wanted to put up examples. So across the country, we have examples of intervention programs. There's Life After Hate, the organization whose name I couldn't come up with earlier, who's an NGO model for doing intervention. There are examples of sort of law enforcement centered and managed and catalyzed programs. The LA PATH program, which, you know, has a law enforcement core but links to, you know, other mental health capability for responding to targeted violence threats, whether they're from extremist sources and others. And then these models that I've alluded to before that are very multidisciplinary, that may have law enforcement at the table, that may have law enforcement slightly back from the table, maybe separate from law enforcement. And so this is a mission area where what's working at the local level looks a lot different. And so whatever the federal strategy is, it can't sort of impose a cookie cutter model across the nation. So just to sum up, the summary findings from this. I mean, it really does appear that terrorism prevention could be a complement to traditional law enforcement here. I mean, there's a lot that we lose by just having the response to sort of nascent threats be criminal justice focused. To do that, I mean, we're not there. We haven't invested that much in building that capability, so it's probably not a surprise that we're not there. But we think that this could actually be very beneficial. Getting to that point won't be easy, though. I went through those design challenges on one slide. Some of them are tough. We need programs that law enforcement is comfortable with and believe are effective and meet their mission needs. And we also need civil society organizations to be able to look at those programs and also be all right that they are reflecting what's important and, you know, valuable to them. I have just said in one sentence something that is a very high bar to get over. There are some local examples of places where it looks like that's worked, where there are, you know, are models that could be learned from, but doing that broadly is going to be tough. But we think it's worth going about it, because then you get to something that's both sort of effective and practical and can be sustained over time. And so just to sort of distill out, you know, kind of the congressional lens on this, I mean, this is a problem space where, I mean, it needs to be funded. There isn't a whole lot of funding at the local level. For a while, there was hope that philanthropy would step in and sort of fill the gap in this area. That really hasn't happened. And so finding a way for federal support of these programs that, you know, sort of doesn't get in the way of their success is critical. I mean, for one part of that is, you know, funding not just out of security-focused agencies like DHS or the FBI, but non-security-focused agencies like HHS or Department of Ed, too. And figuring out a way where that works with the other mission spaces of those agencies, too. Because, you know, all of these agencies have multiple missions and multiple risks and threats that they're charged with dealing with. But the other piece of this is, you know, figuring out how to support these programs in a way that really enables experimentation and innovation. There was focus early on. There's concerns about whether these programs work. They're hard to evaluate. And so even from the very beginning, there was a lot of emphasis on, you know, trying to measure what we're doing and you know how many events have been prevented. I mean, some of those answers are probably unknowable, although potentially estimable. But we're at a point now where we still have a lot to figure out here. You know, figuring out what the models are that work for civil society organizations and law enforcement. You know, we've got some examples, but you know, we've got to figure out how those work and how they can be sustained. You know, before we get to the point where we start, you know, sort of turning the screws on evaluation. And so, from our read, you know, we're as a country in this mission space still early, but there's a lot of potential for you know how this could kind of advance and make it easier to respond to threats before things happen. Anyway, I'll stop. I've run over. any questions?
This presentation is provided as a public service by the RAND Corporation. Visit www.rand.org to learn more about these issues and to explore RAND's free online library of more than 10,000 policy reports and commentaries.